Hello, I'm Andries Vantanar, the solar analyst for Rethink Energy, and joining me today is Scott Wharton, the CEO of Tandem PV, and we'll be talking about perovskites. Your company is one of the, I think, the three leading four-terminal tandem perovskite companies in North America, which might end up really being leading in the world as well. I'll just give a brief overview for anyone who isn't familiar with perovskites of what they are. They're an alternative photovoltaic semiconductor to silicon. They're actually less powerful in and of themselves if you just have one layer. So there's really two routes to market for perovskites. One is you just do the single layer perovskites, and that's cheap and it's very thin film. So you can put it on the sides of buildings, you can put it on satellites, you can put it on small scale electronic devices. But that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking to one of the many companies, well, perhaps a dozen or so, and you're one of maybe half a dozen of the most prominent, that combines it with silicon. So you'll have a layer of perovskite that is on top of the silicon in a solar module. And that is a pretty straightforward way to get a more powerful solar panel. And of course, it costs a little bit more to make per square meter because you've got an extra company to fund. But it's so worth it. You can leverage a huge module cost increase if you had to per square meter. You're going to tell me, though, that it's not an increase per watt.
First of all, I think that's a good explanation of what a tandem is. I think I like telling people it's kind of like a sandwich where you put two solar panels together. And different people make them a different way. Some people try to make the perovskite directly on it, which has some pros and cons, which I'm sure we can talk about if you want. And we're making more of an abstraction layer where we can work with any silicon provider. We're not making the silicon ourselves. But yeah, I think the way you covered it is right, is that you get performance that's way better. In fact, I would say unattainable to standalone silicon, which allows you to get a bunch of value props. One, higher efficiency, but two, lower total cost of ownership because you have lower labor costs, lower land costs, lower balance of systems costs because you get a much higher efficient panel in the same size.
And that is one of the reasons why like perovskites are so inevitable, is that the silicon can't go much further. The theoretical maximum efficiency limit is somewhere like 27% to 29% for silicon. And once you include some practical concerns, I think the highest efficiency silicon module is 24.5% today. I don't expect them to go past 25% or 26% really ever. And that, yeah. And what's the tandem efficiency that you're looking at? Firstly, like next year and also in 10 years?
Well, today we're around 26%. What I would say is I see near-term visibility to exceeding 30, which I think I use that number because I think for a lot of people it's, either you start talking about a little bit better, but 30 is so much better and better, as you said, than silicon will ever be, that it shows you both the near-term promise of why people are moving to tandems. But the theoretical limit is about 45%. So the way we would see this developing is that first you have a tandem that uses the silicon, they use different part of the light or the band gap. Over time, I would see that silicon goes away and you have two parts of the perovskite. And the main reason why I see that is that the perovskite is so much thinner and ultimately is going to be a lot cheaper to make. I mean, it's basically about 200 times thinner than the silicon. So ultimately, the cost of goods is just going to be lower.
Yeah, you're ultimately painting something that's 1 micron thick, the photovoltaic itself. And, yeah. And you just put that onto, you actually put it onto the glass, don't you, that's used to assemble a normal solar module.
We do. So it's, in a way, if you think about what we're doing, I try to describe it to people, it's less like building a silicon solar panel, which I think is more akin to a semiconductor where you heat it up really high and you purify it. It's more like making like a TV or special kind of window where a lot of the cost is really in the glass.
So maybe let's discuss Tandem PV's history just a bit. So like how long has it been going on for? What have you done since you stepped in as CEO? Quite recently, wasn't it? Half a year ago.
Yes, about 8 months ago I joined. So the company itself has been around about 8 years. It was founded by Colin Bailey and Chris Eberspacher. Part of why I joined is I love the fact that the two of them were both completely committed to solar and their careers were in different ways. So Colin actually built the first tandem panel at Stanford when he was getting his PhD 10 years ago, first panel in the world. And it really is his first job out of Stanford with his PhD in material science. So really smart guy, totally focused on building this tandem panel and tandem vision. That's why the company is called Tandem. So it's nice that we have kind of, in a way, the generic name for where the industry is going. And then Chris, part of why I was excited to work with Chris is that he spent the last literally 40 years in solar, dedicated his life to it, and he just has an incredible amount of experience with not only technology in the lab, but, you know, more importantly, how do you take things out of the lab and how do you scale them and manufacture them? And I like that there was a balance of science, but also practicality and knowing how to scale things, because I think as the people who are watching or listening to this know, there are a lot of things that kind of work great in a lab, but can you make them? Can you scale them? I like the team's pragmatism, and I was just fortunate also that the company was in my backyard, because it's here in Silicon Valley where I live. And, you know, sure, I could tell you a little bit more of my background too, but I guess maybe I'll start that. I joined 8 months ago. I think kind of the fun thing for me is I've come full circle in my career, in that literally almost 3 decades ago, I was getting my MBA internship at SIA, and I decided to do this while my business school classmates were off getting rich at Goldman Sachs and McKinsey. And I decided to work for SIA for $4 an hour at the time. And I kind of fell in love with the solar industry, but as you can imagine, it was a way different industry. It was small. There really wasn't a fit for someone like me who wasn't either an entry-level engineer or scientist or a salesperson. So I kind of went off and pivoted and did 4 startup scale-ups in a row before this. So I did 2 companies in the voice or IP space that went public. And then the second one got sold to Cisco for $2 billion. Then I moved out to Silicon Valley with my wife, and we founded the first cloud video conferencing service. So I like to say we had the right idea, but we were a little early. We still had a pretty good exit. And then maybe fun for this audience, since we're talking about me and tandem, we had this dream of traveling. So we took our kids out of school, we got rid of our house and cars, and we backpacked around the world for a year. And then when I came back, my wife said, "Do you mind not doing another startup? Because, you know, you've done 3 in a row." So I ended up going to Logitech, where I built their internal video conferencing business from $62 million to over $1 billion a year. And we became the biggest worldwide in video conferencing hardware. So I had 4 successes in a row. I'm running this $2 billion a year business, but, you know, still the solar stuff kind of the back of my head. And when I found this team, learned about perovskites and the opportunity, and of course, I think as people listening know, like we need in the world more innovation. So I decided to jump in with 2 feet, and I'm having a great time.
So your role compared to the people like Ebish Bakker and Colin Bailey is less the kind of scientist, more the we're ready for commercialization. So let's go a bit into detail about the what's called the 4-terminal and the 2-terminal approach. And I used to get these confused a lot, but yours is 4-terminal because effectively you have 2 separate modules on top of each other. It's just that the perovskite one is semi-transparent. Do they actually end up with 2 inverters or 1 inverter?
You use 1 inverter, so you combine them in the same way. They're just, it's an abstraction layer. So if you build the 2-terminal, you're essentially having to completely develop and optimize the perovskite for the silicon because they're combined together. Whereas in the approach that we're taking, we essentially, we don't need to build the silicon, which I think is smart, because why reinvent the wheel for an industry that is hundreds of billions of dollars and, you know, kind of a solved problem? We don't need to build a silicon. Second thing is, we can get the latest technology from anyone else. So some people have asked us, "Scott, are you worried about the recent decline in the cost of silicon modules and cells?" And I go, "Actually, it's kind of a good thing for us, because one of our biggest inputs into our product and costs are silicon cells. So as they've gone down, our economics have actually gotten better over time," which I know is a little bit ironic, you know, given the discussion happening in the world, but I think it's true. Our economics have gotten better. And then the other thing is, it opens up some interesting business model options. So we can make our own tandem, the whole thing. We could potentially OEM our perovskite layer to someone else who's making the silicon. Or I think there are some people out there in the world who we've talked to, like, you know, big companies, big deployers that said, "You know what? I've already chosen my silicon provider and I have a relationship with them. Could you work together? Could I put you together and kind of have a meet in the middle model where we put together?" All those business models are kind of open. Whereas I think if you take the other model, you're constrained by, you know, you make your own silicon and you're competing with the silicon vendors, where we're actually not. Message out there, I think, for everyone listening, is if you're in the traditional silicon industry, I think we could be a good partner for you. We're not a threat. We're more of an opportunity.
Would you actually consider building your own sort of module or glass production capacity? Because it is easier to get into that than into silicon cell, silicon wafer.
Well, our plan right now is to build a full tandem. So we're not going to actually design and build the silicon cells because we can just buy them in the open marketplace. But you know, in terms of building a module, I think most of the people watching know that there's plenty of players out there and plenty of technology that allows you to assemble a module. So we're just going to use that. It's largely off the shelf. It's pretty simple, and we think we know how to do that and add that to our manufacturing, where you just take the two and put them together. We have the flexibility to, if someone came along and said, hey, could we OEM your top part module with the perovskite, combine it? Yeah, we could do that. We could work with multiple players. We're not constrained there.
What I see worldwide, just on the topic of the different approaches like four terminal, two terminal, and single junction perovskite, which is just the perovskite by itself, I see dozens of these thin film companies in East Asia, probably because they're looking at the building integrated segment in those huge cities. Then in the West, it's actually a slight majority for tandem companies. I'm just wondering, do you happen to know if any tandem companies are pursuing two terminal other than Oxford PV? I think it might just be them. Do you know?
I think Swift is also. They're another one. I would add to that. I think anybody who's already building silicon, I think there's a natural thought and inclination to do two terminal because their attitude is like, well, I'm already building silicon. Why don't I just put it together? So I think there's kind of where they are and how they're thinking about it. But because we're not, you know, coming from that point of view, we're not constrained by that way of thinking.
I think in theory, it must be more powerful to have two terminal, because otherwise, why would they do it? Because it does seem to be more complicated and more difficult, which is a real significant difference for where perovskites are right now, which is trying to commercialize.
Well, from my understanding, it's part of it is psychological. Hey, I'm already building this one thing. Why don't I put them together? So it just seems to psychologically make sense. The other thing is, I think there's a slight potential perceived benefit, but then I didn't mention some of the technical drawbacks. Part of the value of our approach is we're allowed, because there's an abstraction layer between the silicon and the perovskite, we can take the most stable part of the perovskite. And whereas in the two-terminal side, my understanding is it kind of forces them to both use specialized kind of silicon, and they use a part of the band gap that is actually less stable. So yes, in theory, they get a slight benefit, theoretically. Practically speaking, they're solving two really hard problems that one of them doesn't need to be solved, in my opinion. And then the other one, it's harder than it needs to be. So I think sometimes, you know, you get into this discussion, I'm sure you can get someone here who would have a completely different argument. I would say the way we're thinking about it is just more pragmatic. Certainly not the purest engineering approach, but oftentimes the purest engineering approach doesn't work.
And they probably are engineers and scientists, and they have that mentality. And it's, you know, possibly counterproductive. But I should stop talking about that until I can get a two-terminal guy back on to defend his position at some point.
Anyway, I'd love to hear them talk about it and debate it, and we'll see who wins.
So speaking on technical challenges, there's kind of ambiguity about perovskite performance so far, which is you really need three different things. For one thing, you need it to be at a size that actually is commercially relevant. So a lot of the original announcements, and there still are some from universities, are on 1 cm². And so they're using various deposition processes that have not, where, yeah, that's great for 1 cm², but they haven't adapted it to industrial scale. So that's one parameter, is the size. Another, of course, is the efficiency. And usually, you know, they want to report record efficiency, so they have great efficiency. And then the third is actually the stability. So could you talk about how you combine those, where you are on all three of those combined?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, one of the things that attracted me to this group, and I'll say with a caveat that I assume that most of people around the world are smart and kind of know what they're doing, but I think sometimes people take different approaches because they have different incentives. I would say the incentive of Colin and Chris is that from the very beginning, they focused on how do we make something that is durable and manufacturable? And I think there are people who have different interests. If you're in a university or you're in a big company lab, you know, maybe your motivation is more to get a record or try things out, but you might not be as practical. So I think part of why they made so much progress over 8 years is really just a lot of trial and error, only really considering things that are practical and really discarding things that, you know, may look great on paper, but will not scale. And there are a lot of things that I think we've seen out there that, you know, I read papers every day, talk about records and efficiency and ideas, and they talk to the team, they go, well, you can never build that. But yeah, it looks great in the lab or great in paper. So I think that's number one. I would say that the feedback that I've gotten from probably multiple dozens of sources, whether it's customers, end users, people in the industry, is that we have the greatest performance in terms of the combination of efficiency, durability, and size. So I would readily admit there are some people that have world records in efficiency. Some of our competitors have made things that are larger, and some may have passed a bunch of tests. But I think what we have is the best combination of the three, which is, I think, what you need to commercialize. So what we've said is we're about 26% for Tandem. But as I said, I think we have visibility to breaking the kind of like what I think is the 4-minute mile barrier in solar, like breaking 30. I think we have visibility to do that, and we will. It's just a matter of when. On the durability side, we've continued to pass all of the standard and relevant IEC tests out there, and we're in the process of updating that. And part of what we said in the past, I'll say again, is that it's part of our what we've said we're doing internally, but we will share that externally as well with some of the external testing. So it's not just believing us. And then generally speaking, we make things that are more on a larger scale. So sometimes, 130 centimeters, sometimes 300, but we're able to show things about, sufficient size. That guy can show over right now because I got it in front of me. How about that? Is this a typical panel that we make? So it's about 300 square centimeters. You can see this, the perovskite layer, and normally it would be semi-transparent, but it's kind of reflective because in the back, you've got a standard silicon cell. So this is an example of something that we can make that we can get roughly about 26% fairly consistently with good durability and reliability. And obviously, sometimes we're making things that push the envelope on both sides. But I would say what I'm proud of is that I think we're pretty close to moving out of pure R&D phase into more of the commercialization phase. We can go make some stuff.
And who are these partners that you're looking at? I used to think that tandems would be all about rooftop because of the power per square meter thing. But it seems like the US rooftop market has suffered so much, and the utility scale vendors or customers are more able to look into this new technology.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we're going to build a product that can be deployed for both, because if you think about the main difference between utility scale and rooftop, whether it's residential or commercial, it's really the size. So the standards are 1x2 meter and rooftops, and 2.7 meters on the utility side. So right now we're focused on the utility side for a few reasons. One is getting a lot of interest from the utility side of the market. Two, I think there's a misperception that utilities only put things out in the middle of the Arizona desert or in the middle of the UAE, where a lot of the utilities we talk to, and that can include also community solar, I would say, which is a form of utility scale or data centers, where people go, you know what, I'm not only putting it in the desert, I'm putting it near a data center or near a city, and the land's kind of expensive. So as the irony is, as the cost of solar comes down, I think the industry is so used to, God, if we can only get the cost down, we can deploy this stuff. But the cost is so competitive now that, first of all, some of the costs are flattening out or not going down. So I was reading the other day, I think it was actually in Rethink, that the cost of glass, like you use the term, is like stubbornly consistent.
Unchanged like for a decade, actually.
That's right. So an increasing, for us, the cost of glass is going to become all more prominent as we go to nanometer scale. That's number one. Number two is cost of land and labor are going the opposite way. They're going up, not down. Same with the cost of acquisition. So when we talk to a lot of our customers, they go, of course, we're concerned about having a competitive price on a panel, but they're also smartly, I think, looking at the cost of the total cost, saying, you know what, if you can save us 40% on land, especially if you're here in California or New Jersey or somewhere like that, or labor, we believe that even if we charged a small premium for our products, we're going to have the lowest cost of energy.
And let's suppose that you, and don't be too outraged by me putting it this way, but let's suppose that you're charging twice the amount per watt for your module, because you're still a small company, you've got all these costs to address, you don't have economy of scale yet, compared to a 5 gigawatt silicon factory. That could still actually be valid, because when you're cramming so much more power per square meter in, it compensates for all these other costs, like land availability, installation. Because someone who's carrying a solar module around doesn't care if you've put a perovskite layer on it at all. Doesn't change the weight. There's all kinds of costs like that don't change. And so you can really afford a lot of cost increase. Although, I don't really know what sort of cost you would have to charge And probably you've got a lot of leeway to work with thanks to the IRA as well.
Yeah, I think I agree with all of that. And I would say that our strategy is to, we think we can charge a small premium. And you're right, I think we could charge more, but our overall philosophy and strategy is you want to get rid of friction in the marketplace. So as a new player, we're obviously introducing some new risks that we would acknowledge compared to an established technology or player. So our strategy is really to make it, you know, very worth, we want to make a profit, as I think most people want us to. And we've got plenty of room to do that with the combination of costs and the IRA, but we also want to make the early partners who deploy, we want to give them a really good deal. So whoever's listening and says, I love the value prop, or I can need, you know, I'm really thinking about labor and the total costs. Our philosophy is great. Whoever goes first, we're going to make it really worth their while. We don't feel like we need to skim all the money. We need to share it with a partner and make it worth their while to go first.
So on the topic of risk, actually, I was thinking the other day, and I've never brought this up, so sorry if I'm springing it on you. You've got the something like 55% of the light not getting to the silicon because the perovskite is in the way. So I used to think that any amount of perovskite power, even if it's really bad, it's still like free bonus power. But that's not quite true. The perovskite does need to be above a certain level. Otherwise, the silicon module is actually worse than it would be without the perovskite. Now, that's only in an extreme theoretical sense, like if the perovskite totally dies. But yeah, what sort of combination of lifespan and efficiency really would be the minimum to just not make it worse on power? And what sort of combination of lifespan and efficiency you're looking for? I think you said the tandem efficiency you're looking at over 30%. In the medium term, but what's the single junction efficiency and the lifespan, if you can say?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say there's no right one answer because different customers are going to have different needs. Like, I think there are some people who have very, very high costs of labor or land, and those will probably be some of our first customers. And they're going to go, you know what? My economics are much better by having more density because they're looking at where the real costs are, not just in the panel. But I would say just conceptually, I think that in any new market, and I think this is true for startups, if you're only a little bit better than the product that is established, it's just not good enough. Like, you have to be quite a bit better. Now, what does that mean in this case? If I had to do a rule of thumb, I would say if TOPCon is around 22, then a tandem needs to be at least 26% or better to be viable. That's our target. I think anybody who says that they can be 1 or 2% better or even worse, maybe that would work for certain use cases like the ones you say, where people are doing it maybe on flexible things where it's lighter or you work with a calculator, you know, new use cases. But I think if you're talking about like for like, let's say utility scale or roof scale, I think it's 26 is kind of the target that we put out there, that it's got to be better than other than if I were in someone's shoes, I probably would not, as a rule of thumb, deploy something that's more risky when I can get the 22% thing. That you know is reliable and is relatively good enough. Although I am hearing stuff about TOPCon saying, yeah, even TOPCon has some issues now being new. Like, it's not completely bulletproof vis-a-vis PERC. But it's still obviously it's a little bit more mature than where perovskites are.
Yeah. Well, I think TOPCon might have actually taken over most manufacturing in China now. So, it's still new. It's still got some issues, but I think like its silver paste usage has probably been slashed an enormous amount recently. That's off topic. So just as a sort of mental calculation, we can look at if we take a 22.5% conventional solar module and compare that to a 26% efficient tandem PV module, so you're adding effectively 15%, not in absolute terms, but you are 115% of the solar of the silicon performance. So you're up 15% on power output. Now, if the module is only like 20% of total project cost, that means you could leverage like a, what's the calculation here? You could leverage almost a 75% module increase on the cost just by comparing those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should do the math, but yes. And then I would also add that, you know, what's interesting, what I've heard from a lot of the utility scale deployers is the domestic content adder. So that's the 10% value they get from deploying it for domestic content. So that could be a lot because that's part of the whole project. So that's not 10% of the panel, that's 10% of the entire project. And if we, you know, look at the numbers that are coming out of Wood Mackenzie Gates, you know, sometimes the panel is only like even 30-40%. So there's a lot more money and savings that you could get on the overall project.
And it still sort of baffles me, but you get to claim the wafer part of the IRA manufacturing subsidy as well, don't you?
Seems to be, yeah. I mean, I would say our economics looks similar in parallel with First Solar because we're building some similar things, although they're CadTel and we're perovskites. But I think if you look at the information about them, which is all public, they stated their rationale for how they characterize the IRA. And I think our belief, based on the advice we got from some lawyers, that we look very similar from that point of view. I think the Calyx people said something very similar when we did our webinar a few weeks ago.
Yeah. So do you have any other business models in mind, like maybe repowering with just perovskite? I guess not at this point. You're quite happy to just sell a premium module that is just the mainstay of the future solar market.
Well, I do think repowering is interesting as you have, you know, we're obviously growing a lot in install base. But there are going to be a lot of fields out there that are at 12, 13, 15, 16%. If we're showing 26, 30%, and you can keep a lot of the balance of systems costs where you don't have to throw that out, I think there are a lot of people who are going to be looking at saying, can I upgrade the panels just like we upgrade, computers or other things where you don't just keep them forever, even though they work. There's going to be some value in doing that. So I think there are a bunch of people who approached us about the idea of repowering and say, what if we could just take the panel and upgrade them and maybe we keep the trackers and maybe we keep the inverters and maybe we keep other things. I think there's an interesting market out there, although, obviously it'll become bigger over time if we're talking about 20, 26, 27 versus now, because the install base is going to get a lot larger.
And I guess we should talk about trade with China. So there was this agenda to reshore the whole solar industry into the US with a mixture of trade barriers, sanctions on Xinjiang, and obviously manufacturing incentives. Now, it seems to me, and you can correct me if you have a different point of view, it seems to me that this has kind of failed on the wafer front because we had Cubic PV canceling its 10 gigawatt factory. We have NextWave still only considering a 6 gigawatt factory. We have the Indians building some wafers, but I think the first one will be a 2.8 gigawatt factory next year, which is like, well, is that enough to supply maybe Florida or something? It's just not very big at all compared to the global industry. And it seems to me like the modules and cells can and really are being reshored. The polysilicon still exists from 10, 20 years ago in the West, but wafers, it seems like the supply will be coming from China. And if you really want to, you can buy it from wafer factories in Vietnam that are owned by Chinese giants. But also, the trade restrictions don't seem to be going to be levied on these wafers like they have been on the cells and modules, but not as strictly. So what you're looking at is, I think you will be using solar modules that use Chinese wafers most likely, unless you go for the Vietnam option. But you do represent a sort of reshoring because you've got this extra layer of American manufacturing on top of that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, first I would say it's very difficult to predict where the politics of this is going to go. I mean, the only observation I think most of us are seeing is that there certainly seems to be a desire for major regions, whether it's the United States or Europe or India, to have their own indigenous power sources and not rely 100% on China. So I think you'll see continued political movements and legislative actions to try to reinforce that. Now, the problem is it's a moving target because, as you said, I think a lot of the incentives that were contemplated in the IRA 2 years ago are probably economically not sufficient to bring some of those things back.
Because they designed the subsidies when the price was at its peak, and I think they underestimated how much it would fall. Sorry, go ahead.
I think that's true. I think also we're continuing to see that, and I think this is the observation, is that the Chinese economy is organized as such that they're not organized based fully on supply and demand and making profit. There's a lot of oversupply and overinvestment because it is state organized, which is leading to an oversupply around the world. So that's causing imbalances. I think different regions will have to figure out what to do with that. But I think in the short term, the implication seems to be that everybody that I have observed that announced something in the supply chain, the silicon side, other than assembly, has basically either backed out or probably will back out in the near future. The nice thing, as I said, about perovskites, and maybe we have some parallels with First Solar and CadTel, is that most of our supply chain is here in the US. So We're not only are we not really affected by that, but if the price stays where it is or goes down on silicon cells, like I said, we actually benefit from that in some ways. And then, you know, we'll have a choice, and I think it'll be a business model choice. Do we get those things on the open market that are could be Chinese, or do we have the option of getting them from here or Southeast Asia or India or somewhere else? I think the good news is we have an option to decide based on, you know, say what our customers want. Do they want a little cheaper from China? I mean, let's assume the market is the way it is right now and doesn't fundamentally change. There may be some people that say, do you want to get it from China at a slightly cheaper rate, or are you willing to pay a slight premium to get it from a player like Qcells or MyBurger or Maxeon or someone else to get more of the domestic content there? Now, I think what's interesting there is it may actually be cheaper for utilities to deploy something that is not from China or not from Southeast Asia, because you get that 10% adder of the whole project.
Now, that's very interesting. So I shouldn't completely give up and disregard this reshoring effort, and shouldn't say it's totally failed on the wafers yet, because they might bring another round of political decision-making into play.
I mean, it's a moving target, but even if you're reading it today, if you read, I read about the CEO of First Solar talking about how, hey, this is the implication of what's happening there. And I think we're seeing around, like I said, I think you go back to where the fundamentals are. I think if you look around the world, most major regions around the world want to have their energy come completely from one source, regardless of whether it's China or not. I think what we learned from Europe and Vladimir Putin was, yeah, maybe that wasn't such a great idea to have it all come from one place. So I think even if it is a moving target and even prices keep changing, I think there's still a will to make sure that we have an indigenous industry here. I think the IRA certainly helps a ton to do that. I think you'll see more happening in that area to kind of reinforce that political objective.
I was talking to some people working for an organization that I think was doing research for the government here in Australia, and you could tell, and they were writing about these reshoring efforts, but you could actually tell they thought it was stupid, because we've kind of waited and watched the Chinese invest $100 billion into something that now is pretty cheap. And now we're going to try and reshore it. It's like, can't we find something else? That's just one perspective, though.
I mean, one of the reasons why I'm excited about Tandem is I think that there are two ways, and this speaks to, I think, my experience in Silicon Valley. There are two ways to kind of run a business. One is you go into the existing business and you just compete head on with whoever is the lower cost provider. And it's not an innovation. It's just really on who can drive the cost down or subsidize the most. I think that's what you see happening in the silicon industry. I personally have no interest in playing in that market. That's just, that's as most people say, that is the red ocean strategy where everybody just cuts each other's throats on cost. Part of what I love what we're doing is we're playing in a different play. We're playing on innovation. So while we're in the energy industry and it's price sensitive, I think you've written about this and others that perovskites ultimately has the structure to prevail over time. Now, if we just did one thing and we stopped and then everybody caught up, yeah, we would probably lose, but obviously that's not the Silicon Valley playbook. It's to come up with something new and then double or triple down on R&D and keep innovating. I think there's a lot of innovation that we can do, both in terms of driving the cost down of manufacturability, but also, like I said, innovating in terms of new form factors or eliminating the silicon over time, because the underlying perovskite should be cheaper. So I'm pretty bullish on what we're doing, but like any startup I've done, and this is number five, me personally, or being involved in boards and investments. Yeah, if you're a startup and you don't stay ahead, you die. But
because what I'm thinking is that perovskites, you know, I published a report about this. I expect perovskites to take over really by, I think it was 2038 or something like that. So you've got 14 years of basically no competition with a peer, because you and your fellow perovskite companies will just be taking over from silicon. So you just have an inherent qualitative advantage for 14 years. And only after that point do you have to start doing any peer competition.
There's that. And I'm also betting that, of course, there will be more people observing what we're doing. There will be more competition in the perovskite space. What I'm betting is that what we have to do is we just have to keep innovating and move faster. And in my experience, smaller companies have some advantage. You know, we have a lot of disadvantages, but we also have a lot of advantages about moving faster and innovating and growing. And what I would say is any small company that goes too slowly and lets a big company catch up is going to die. That's the law of the jungle. Now, I think we have some inherent advantages to go faster, but we have to execute. If we don't execute, we won't. Somehow, I think that people look at Silicon and they look in the past and they go, well, we've basically innovated slowly and it's been more like process engineering. What I like about this is this a leapfrog platform change that can allow us to keep going ahead. And, you know, that's what I'm betting on, is that we can keep innovating, not just the first 26%, but everything coming up ahead of there.
Do you think you would be in a more precarious position if First Solar was a silicon company? Because then it might be able to get into tandems more easily and take everything over.
No, I don't. I mean, what's interesting about most businesses is that you find that smaller companies can move ahead and take more risks, generally speaking. Larger companies have more to lose, so they wait longer. Right, it's just the law of the world. You rarely have a bigger company going out first because it doesn't make sense for them. They'd rather wait and wait till the market's bigger or scaler. So, I mean, to some extent, I don't think it really makes much of a difference. I think the difference in this market is going to be more around what is your risk profile, what is your ability to innovate and come up with new things. I'm betting that we're going to do okay there, and I'm betting that a lot of the larger companies will try to catch us. Always happens. I've been on both sides multiple times. And this is what's fun about Silicon Valley. It's where so many industries, I'm thinking of writing a blog about this. There's so many industries, especially ones that I've been in, and where the title of it would be, you can't win because of dot, dot, dot. And, you know, my early days in telecom, it was, you can't win because of Alcatel and Ericsson and Lucent. And you can't win because of Cisco. And every time I've won, same playbook. And in this case, it's, you can't win because of China, right? But, you know, we hear that all the time. And the world is littered with people who say, you can't win. And then some small company comes up and gets bigger and they innovate. And I think it's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to playing the game again.
So that would be a pretty good way to end it. But I want to ruin that by asking how your manufacturing efforts are going. So what's your production capacity now, and what sort of scale are you looking at reaching next?
So right now we're producing more in an R&D scale. So we're not producing anything that we could sell commercially. So part of our plan is to, well, like I said, I think we are in the late R&D stage. We're moving into the commercialization stage. In order to do that, we need to raise more money, buy some tools, build a pilot plant, and then work your way backward. I'm feeling confident that based on the performance we're seeing, we're going to be able to start that process soon. And I know we've talked about when this stuff's going to get into the market in, you know, 2026 or not. And I'm betting that it will be, not for everyone, but I feel like really good about our prospects to do that.
So far, I think the biggest single installation was 1 megawatt in China. And I mentioned it to you, and you pointed out that that was by the perovskite company's own investor. So there's still, we still haven't seen someone really cross the finish line and start lapping the others. So
yeah, I think as an observation, anybody who has money to spend can buy tools, right? That doesn't mean that the product works. Anybody can deploy it out in the field if they want to spend the money on it. That doesn't mean that the product is ready. So I think you have to just take it with a balanced view. And I think we're trying to strike the right balance of moving at the right time where we feel it's ready to start scaling up, but not before then. And I think there are some players out in the market that feel compelled to spend lots of money on a pilot plant or deploying it when the stuff's not ready. I don't think you really gain very much. I think you just waste time and money.
I think there's something like at least 500 megawatts of, I've probably got more in my Excel spreadsheet, but at least 500 megawatts of nominal perovskite production capacity that just isn't really being used. It's being used at the same R&D scale that you have, basically. So,
well, around that, this is one of the things I've observed about the industry too, is that people announce a nameplate and they're not actually making it. So, all right, somebody announces 100 and maybe they're making one half.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe. So I just would caution.
10 kilowatts on their roof.
Here. Take it with a grain of salt, which is also why I think we're trying to be a little bit more conservative on the claims that we make without backing them up with third-party validation.
You don't want to end up like Oxford PV, where I think they originally were 12 months away from commercialization in 2019, and I think they're still 12 months away. So
Yeah. I mean, it often happens in technology. It's like, I can't necessarily fault them for that, but.
Well, I'll fault them for you, so you don't have to backbite your colleagues. Anyway, I think we've covered everything in this. Is there something else you'd like to cover?
No, I just, I think that, I'll go back to the report that you did. I think it's about 4 or 5 months ago where you talked about why did you say that perovskites would be 90% by 2040? I think it just goes to the fundamentals of one, the economics are there fundamentally. Two, the performance is there. I think the third thing that I would say is, and I've observed this in almost every startup industry I've been, people say, how do you know that the technology is going to go in this direction? And what I answer is, when everybody in the industry says they're going there, it has to go there because it's the only choice. If everybody's building in one platform, that's what's going to happen. Just because if everybody builds the same thing, it has to happen. I think there is a consensus now that in order to get to the next level, we're going to go from PERC to TOPCon, maybe HJT, but it has to go to perovskites and tandem. So I'm confident it'll get there. Will it be tandem or someone else? I don't know. I'm going to do my best to... with the team to make it happen. And we'll see. It's part of the fun of why I, fun or the craziness, I guess, of why I joined the fifth startup in a row.
Yeah. And I really agree about perovskites being inevitable because there are, these premature announcements at times. There are all these technical reasons to be, these technical hurdles that have to be addressed. And so there is uncertainty about when it will arrive, but I'm not uncertain at all about the fact that it will arrive. Because silicon, you look at the heterojunction, monoperc, TOPCon, that sort of progression, it's a huge amount of expenditure, and all they're getting each time is another 0.5% efficiency. And you look at the other things that the other photovoltaics used, like gallium arsenide on satellites. I had that chap, Tom Fontaine, tell me that that was an enormous fraction, actually, of the cost of a small satellite. And perovskites totally blow that out of the water. Perovskites can get up to an extra half again as much power of silicon, so they blow that out of the water. I think they're already competitive on power output with the other traditional thin film options like SiGs and cadmium telluride. So they blow that out of the water in another year or two, as well as being cheaper. This is just really the only option. It's almost like green hydrogen. So a total tangent, but we've been writing about green hydrogen. And right now it's having some delays and uncertainty. But what's the other option? The other option is blue hydrogen, which is more polluting. So eventually it will have to go and you're just left with green.
Yeah. I mean, I would even go further than that and saying the difference between hydrogen and solar is that hydrogen still has a cost premium to traditional things in the market, where solar is already cheaper. So yeah, with hydrogen, I think there's a question of when hydrogen will become viable in the market and then how to do it. With solar, as you know, and everybody's listening here, there's no more question about that anymore, that solar is the standard, will be the de facto one. So, I'm actually really excited for the world and gratified that even with traditional silicon, without perovskites, we can really beat net zero. What I like about doing this is that I think, does the world really just want to transition with the same amount of power? Or do we want to make sure that everyone in the world has way more power, especially not just the, you know, the billion of people or so live in Western Europe, Australia, North America, but, you know, the other 7 billion people in the world who don't live like we do. And part of why I wanted to do this as a motivation is I think net zero is where we'll get to, and it's great. But how about making, you know, energy so cheap that everybody can live as well as we do, you know, in ANZ in the West? And I think perovskites will get us there. Energy has been the one thing that is the constant worldwide that allows people to have a better standard of living. And I don't think there's just transitioning energy is not enough. We need to have way more of it. It needs to be way cheaper. I feel like I can see the path to getting there. And I'm super excited and proud of that what we're doing there.
And we've seen the existing conventional solar industry triple in 3 years, I think. So, and you're the next step, really.
Yeah, we need to take it to the next level. And I have no doubt that there is an unlimited demand for people who want electricity and power for anything, both the stuff we're doing now and powering all those crazy NVIDIA chips that people are in, AI chips that people are going to buy. And then, you know, everything else that we're going to need. There's like a, just like software, there's an unlimited demand. We will never be satiated for computing power, and we will never be satiated for electricity.
I actually heat my office up sometimes with running an AI on my computer that's powered by my solar and battery. So yeah, that hits close to home.
You need solar to cool it off with air conditioning.
Yes, absolutely. I think that covers everything. Thanks for your time. I hope to speak to you soon again. I'll be publishing a new Perovskite report in hopefully 3 months, because it's what everyone likes.
It is. Well, let's keep it hot. Always enjoy talking to you. And thanks for the opportunity to have this conversation.